Okay, hi everybody. Good afternoon. My name is Jenny Barber. I'm the director of the Australasian Open Access Strategy Group. I'm really delighted to be here talking to you about openness and equity in academic research. And I just want to give thanks to Gemma Walsh for organising this and allowing us to set this up and give me an opportunity to speak to you. I'm going to cover quite a large range of things in this talk. I hope that we'll have time for questions at the end. And obviously, I'm very happy to be contacted afterwards, and my details are all available, all there on the website for you to see. So, just a little bit first of all about what we are. We are the Open Access, Australasian Open Access Strategy Group is a group of 19 universities in Australia and all the New Zealand universities, and we have as affiliate members Creative Commons Australia and Toa Toa, which is the equivalent in New Zealand. As I say, we're a membership-based organisation, and we have a group. All of our members are actively involved and interested in open scholarship more generally. And I'll come on a bit to other folk that we work with. We have an executive committee, Martin Borchert, who's the university librarian at UNSW, is our chair, and three other members from across Australia. I'm based at QUT, as is Sandra Fry, and Sandra does our newsletters and organises webinars, etc. And if you have any sort of logistical things, please feel get in contact with either her or me. So, what do we do as a group? So, first off, we have four pillars of things that we work along, and I just really wanted to flag this because it sort of sets the scene for everything that we do. We spend quite a lot of time advocating to government funders and government. We also work with a lot of partners nationally and regionally and internationally, and for example, we are well in contact with initiatives that are happening overseas, and one of our jobs is really to be involved and in and aware of what's happening there. We do general raising awareness, by which I mean, for example, articles, media in the general press. So Martin did an interview on Radio National this year, and I've written for some non-specialist publications. We see that as a very important part of our job. And then the last bit is around capacity building for our members, and we have an active membership. And this year, we actually increased our membership very substantially, and a large part of what we've been focusing on this year is capacity building in the form of workshops, trying to really get everybody up to speed with what the key issues are in open access. And doing this webinar is obviously an important part of feeds into many of those initiatives. So, I've got a lot of things I'm going to cover. I said we've only got an hour and we will finish on the hour, and I will gallop through them at quite high speed. So I do hope that it's fine for you to feel like if there's too much in here that you think that I'm not getting to, feel free to follow up with me afterwards. I won't, what I wanted to, sorry, just go back quickly. What I did want to cover at and touch on is some specific issues, in particular in legal publishing. Now, I'm very much not an expert in legal publishing, and I know that all of you are. So feel free, particularly, to ask questions about that, and I'd be very interested in any challenges that you see specifically from that point of view. Okay, so the first, just to set the scene really, is the concept of open access versus free access. So we have lots of conversations often about free access to the literature or to research publications or to the academic literature more widely. And for a long time, we've really just been focusing on free to read books or PDFs or some other free type of literature. But increasingly, the conversation now is around open access, and open access is very important as a concept because it explains what not just the fact that you could that not just the access to research, but actually the fact what you can do with it. So a core component of that is the Creative Commons licenses, which I'll talk about in a moment, but also the rights of authors to be attributed. So authors retain the copyright for fully open access articles. And then a final pillar of it is the permanent archiving. So wherever that happens, whether it's at a journal, whether it's in a database, it's not something that is simply available once and never again, but can be permanently accessed under these conditions. So the Creative Commons licenses, as I said, are key enablers of this, and this is one of the reasons why we work closely with Creative Commons in Australia and New Zealand. And the parts that I just wanted to highlight for the purpose of this talk are, well, first of all, on the left, that licenses are have three layers to them. So there's the legal code, which explains in great depth what one can do with an article based on the license. There's the human readable part of it, which is very important. And I used to work at PLOS Medicine, and all of the articles that you'll see published, for example, within those journals, we have a very short, clear statement that makes it extremely explicit what you can do with those articles, because we do know that many times people do just pick up a PDF and read it, and they want to know exactly what they can do with it. But the third part of a Creative Commons license, which is arguably the most important, I would say, is the machine readable part of it. And that's the part that really it shows what can be done with an article when it's being harvested. And we know increasingly that a huge amount of the literature is accessed and harvested, at least in the first instance, by machines. And having a fully machine readable license on an article is, or any other research output, is incredibly important. And of course, Creative Commons licenses can be applied beyond research. There are a multitude of sources that you can go to looking for choosing a license. I've just put on the right one that Nerida developed at Creative Commons Australia, and it's on their website. And that explains that the full range of the licenses, through from the most common one, which is the Creative Commons Attribution License, which is the one at the top, through to ones that are more restrictive right at the bottom. So those ones that don't allow commercial use, don't allow share, don't allow derivative works, and also put specific limitations, for example, on how things may be shared subsequently. And then right at the bottom, there is the all rights reserved, which is probably the type of statement you're very familiar with seeing on many types of articles. It is important to have a good knowledge of these when, particularly if you're advising anyone around open access, because the licenses can be complicated to understand, but they do really, particularly in areas where it's not obvious what reuse, subsequent reuse might happen, picking the right license is very important in making sure that people make informed choices about what they do with their research. And I pointed out, I put some couple of websites there. So I'm going to move on now to talking about some key emerging developments. Now, I'm very aware that some of these will not be so important for perhaps the particular legal research, but I thought it was worth noting because I think they are what's driving the change globally, and they may well be areas that you hear about. All right, let me move on. We've talked about Creative Commons licenses, so we've talked about the key emerging developments. So just to go back to what this looks like on a sort of international scale. We're seeing a real change in the ecosystem for open scholarship. Everything from open protocol registration, which is increasingly common in the biological field, through to post-publication peer review, which is happening in the... okay, all right. Thank you for your patience. It's always a delight to do these things live. All right, here we go. Hopefully you're now seeing the slide with the academic publishing. So there'll be some things in here that you'll be very familiar with, and some of which that perhaps you're not quite so familiar with. I would just say that some ones that are particularly interesting that I think are changing, I'll come on to in a moment about, particularly in preprints, but one of the, I think what we are seeing on a really massive scale is the emergence of new models. So the traditional models that we used to have with publishing are just simply, changing from where we were a few years ago. Okay, so this is a slide that I use when I'm talking about open scholarship across the publishing life cycle. Preprints are, I know, something that are used within legal publishing, and they're becoming actually incredibly important now within biomedical publishing. We have open scholarship can also happen at the point of view of the accepted version or the postprint, and that may well be something that you're familiar with, particularly if you're working within universities. And then the last type of open access, of course, is what happens at journals or book publishing. Just to note, if you are advising or are in receipt of funding from funders within Australia, we do know that both the only types of open access that are currently acceptable for those funders are open access at university repositories or at journals or books. It's preprints currently do not fulfill that requirement. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how that develops over the next few years. There are some funders, particularly within the health sciences in Europe, for example, where preprints are very important as models for open publishing. And then just to reinforce what that looks like in terms that I'm sure you're very familiar with are the repository-based open access, which is often called green open access, journal-based, which is often called gold open access, and then a rise of publishing, which is called hybrid open access, which is associated with open access of specific articles within an otherwise subscription model. The issue with this is that it's a very expensive model for open access, but particularly within the life sciences, it is absolutely something that publishers are pushing because it is a very lucrative model for them. And I'll talk a little bit later about the pushback from that that's coming from international funders. Okay, so let's talk a bit about some of the drivers. So the first one is the moves by funders. And the most significant one, again, that you may well have heard of is Plan S, which is this move from from a group of funders within the European Union, initially requiring that open access happened right at the beginning, by the beginning of 2020, but is now actually has been pushed back to 2021. But what they are asking for is open access, immediate open access with a Creative Commons license on the research output for any of the research that they publish. And that is driving quite a substantial change in how many people globally are thinking about open access. What that means specifically, as well as that overarching principle, there are 10 supporting principles, and I've summarized them here. And what these, I won't go through them in detail, but what I would just say is that a key component of this is, first off, that there is an expectation that funders and universities take the lead in supporting publishing costs. So that's principle number four. But also for principle number seven, although this is primarily for research articles, there is a recognition that books and monographs will need to be part of this ecosystem, but it will take longer for this to happen. Now, most of the funders and organisations that have signed up to this at the moment are science-based, but I would say that it is likely that we will be seeing increasingly in the future that other types of funders are supporting this, and so it may well be something that you'll want to be aware of for your particular area. And the routes to compliance for Plan S, well, I mentioned the journal-based route, which is the gold-based route. The second route is via repositories in universities or elsewhere. And the third route is through hybrid journals, but only ones that are signed up to transformative agreements. And what that means practically is that it's going to very much change the way that publishers have to think about what they're delivering, what services they're providing. And so it's an incredibly interesting time at the moment. We're seeing a real sort of back and forth between publishers and funders and universities, a sort of very rich dialogue now about how open scholarship might move forward. And these are the things that I think are happening on a kind of consistent level, which is that it has really been born out of the fact that funders are increasingly impatient with publishers, and particularly in the case of the life sciences, where this has been a real key driver. So just moving on to some next issues that I think are worth exploring. So the second real driver of change is preprints. Now, I know that there are preprint models within legal publishing, and it's expanding across a number of areas globally. This is just a screenshot that I grabbed yesterday. It doesn't unfortunately include any of the legal preprint servers, but what it shows really nicely is the increasing number of preprints that are emerging globally. And just as you can see that from at the bottom, that in Australia is a very active participant in this, with more than 30,000 preprints from authors here. And across all disciplines. So it is absolutely not just confined to, for example, physics, which is where it originally started, or to the biological sciences. The two that I pulled out that I thought I would just highlight, which I'm sure you're incredibly familiar with, are both SSRN and the Law Archive. SSRN is an interesting initiative, and again, I know it's a very important route for dissemination for legal research. The issue behind it at the moment, as you may well be familiar, is that it was bought by Elsevier a couple of years ago, and Elsevier is obviously one of the very big players within publishing. And that really, that whole driver of the kind of buy-up of publishers, smaller organisations that support scholarship, is one of the drivers behind both the rise of Plan S, but also the rise of things such as Law Archive, which I put on the right-hand side, which is an open source initiative for legal publishing. And I expect that as over the next few years, we're going to see more and more of the types of new initiatives such as Law Archive arising. The third thing just to note is about the publishing economy, which we know is changing quite dramatically. I won't go into this on a large scale, but I think it's worth noting that in particular, one of the things that we are seeing is that there is an absolute interest in universities and on some occasions countries. So for example, the University of California is one example, Germany is another example, of where groups that make big consortial developments are completely are pushing back against their current subscription models, and they are absolutely requiring and expecting better deals, and we're seeing as a result of that cancellations for publishing. What's particularly interesting about this is that, first off, that these have been done with the great support in the main of their academics. So, and that has been very important. For example, the University of California has spent a great deal of time working with their academics to make them understand, help them understand why they are choosing to cancel until they get deals that they feel include, that are better for them, not just for subscriptions, but which also include the ability to make future research open. And I would watch this space with great interest. If you are interested, Spark, which is one of the big open access organizations in the US, has a cancellation tracking deal that is pretty fascinating reading. And what we're seeing increasingly is that models for that universities are negotiating, and indeed countries are negotiating, are not just for subscriptions, but include the idea of making research open. Another concept just to think about is this idea of open access being part of a bigger vision of open scholarship. I'll touch on in a moment what that really looks like, but the idea is that we need to be moving away from a monolithic model of publishing that is only serves, you know, sort of particular disciplines well, through to something that looks much more diverse. And we've seen that really emerge very dramatically across biomedical research, and I expect that it's going to start happening on a much more global level across most disciplines. In humanities, I'll just give a couple of examples of really interesting consortial models that have arisen. Open Library of Humanities is one of them. Knowledge Unlatched is another initiative for the humanities. Were really areas where open access was not considered tremendously important until a few years ago, and until essentially scholar-led initiatives were developed. What this means from a point of view of developing something pragmatically is that we need to build the infrastructure around it to make this all possible. And a concept that you is very well established for data is becoming more established for research outputs more generally, and may well also be moving into sort of areas where this hasn't been a particular concept in the past, is this concept of FAIR. So FAIR stands for findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable. And it puts a framework for how one might actually make research open without having at a quite granular level. And so what this looks like, kind of the nuts and bolts of it are at the top, I've put a couple of permanent identifiers. So one of them is digital object identifiers, which are for research outputs, and there are other equivalent ones out there. ORCID is the key permanent identifier for academics, and I would be extremely interested to know how we actually have a whether this is something that is coming consistently within law research or not. Accessible is this concept of having archives where it's possible to access things permanently. Again, there's a huge diversity of these now available. Interoperable is an interesting concept, and I would be very interested to hear your concept, how this works in your area. But you know, for example, within the life sciences, you know, the concept of data being in a format that it can be properly interrogated is very important. And then I touched on the importance of the Creative Commons licenses at the end. Okay, just some other things that are going on in the background, which may be of interest, is the need for open infrastructure. So I touched on the fact that some of these really key organisations are being bought up by larger publishers. So SSRN is an example of that. There are three initiatives that are really trying to take this on at a global level. So there's one which is called SCOS, which stands for Sustainable Coalition for Open Scholarship, which is developing a way of a consortial model for funding particular parts of the open ecosystem. A bigger one, which is looking forward to future initiatives, is one called Invest in Open. And then the final one is a very interesting initiative, which works on open access repositories. And there's an international group called the Confederation of Open Access Repositories. They're actually looking at the current repository system that we have right now, which underpins most of open scholarship in Australia, for example, and trying to understand how that might work in the global ecosystem. Another concept to think about is one about integrity. Well, this is particularly important in areas where reproducibility is becoming a very important issue. Not just in science, but also in some other areas of social science, for example. And a very interesting thing that happened earlier this year was a conference that I attended at the World on research integrity, where the whole issue around open scholarship has been core to quality of research, particularly if the need to access the data associated with publications has become a really top priority. And in Australia, that is also a topic of great interest for the Australian research funders, particularly the National Health and Medical Research Council, but also increasingly the Australian Research Council, and the chief scientist has taken this on as something that they want to follow. And then a final thing just to think about with regard to what's driving change is the changing incentive structures. And this is a really key issue. We know that it's almost impossible to change the incentive structure, particularly within academic research, if we only have incentive structures that are tied to where journals, where people publish, you know, the journal-based metrics, the journal impact factors, which is the most most people are familiar with, is actually a terrible way of accessing research. Developing the quality, understanding the quality of research. And so this initiative called the Declaration on Research Assessment is trying to build a really strong community of practice globally, which will actually allow us to think about what incentives should we be putting in place if we want to make research more open. And I think one particular thing I think will be very interesting in this is the idea that we have different types of research outputs that become valued as important for research. And that may well work very well in areas where journal articles are not the prime route to making research open. Okay, so the next thing I just want to touch on is what's happening regionally. So as with many of these things, it's a complete alphabet soup, I'm afraid, of all the groups that are involved. And I'm sure that you'll have other groups that you're involved with that are also interested in this area. Just to highlight that Australia has actually been very important in open access from the very beginning. ANU had a repository back in 2000, QUT had a policy in 2003. But what we're seeing as we move through to certainly to the late, towards 2020, is there an increasing number of groups that are getting very involved with open scholarship. And so that includes government and it includes sort of quasi-government such as the Productivity Commission. Specifically, the thing that has been a very big driver is open access policies from the two big funders, so the ARC and the NHMRC. That, for example, is not the case in New Zealand at the moment. They don't have any funders with national policies. That has been incredibly important, and their policies, both around access to the full papers themselves, but also to descriptions of the research themselves, the metadata requirements, are very important. Unfortunately, what we know, however, is that despite having these policies been in place now from 2012, we still have very low levels of open access more generally. So in the most recent ERA initiative, the Excellence for Research Australia, where universities were required to report how much of their work was open access, only 32% of research articles were, and it's similar across Australia and New Zealand for similar types of outputs. For book publishing, we know that it's very much lower, and I suspect that this is something that these funders will be looking at very closely in the next few years. I touched on the building a national approach. These are just some of the groups that have been involved. So ARC, NHMRC, there's groups talking about a fair approach specifically. We know that the Productivity Commission has been very interested and in fact recommended an open scholarship policy back in 2016, which the government has not taken up. And we recommended last year to a committee at the House of Representatives the need for an open scholarship approach, and they took it and have made it one of their recommendations. But we're still at this point waiting to see whether and if the government will respond to that. Okay, so moving on to some kind of specifics of how one might guide strategic publishing. And obviously, this is weighted towards open access, but I want to just highlight some initiatives that I thought that are worth thinking about that are not just open access. One of the things we often hear is, and this is mostly for journals, but there are some, it does touch on some other areas. There are some very good tools available now to guide authors. So probably the most useful one that's freely available for a very wide range of journals is something called Scimago, which you may well be familiar with. It doesn't require a login, and it has, I've pulled up here a set of law journals that it pulls up. If you are in an area where you're having to recommend sort of particular quartiles of journals that people need to publish in, this can be very useful, particularly when it also has quite a number of comparison sites to go to. If you're looking for open access journals specifically, the Directory of Open Access Journals is probably the best place to look at. Again, has a number of journals in it. The ones that I've pulled up here to look at are ones, the law journals just from Australia. It's important when you're directing anyone to publishing in journals, particularly emerging ones, that you can give some confidence that these journals are good quality, and the Directory of Open Access Journals is really the best place to point to. It does also indicate whether or not these journals have article processing charges associated with them. Actually, the ones that are on this page don't have any APCs. You'd see it on the right if they did have. But the final thing just to point to, and this is really, I think, key, because everything is changing so dramatically and there are so many different options to publish in globally, that authors need to be very strategic about their publishing choices. And there's a really nice site called Think Check Submit, which lays out a sort of process to go through when you're making decisions about where to publish. It is also useful, not just for publishing, however, I think it's useful to thinking about when you're trying to understand a journal or read a journal that you haven't previously come across. It can give you an indication of whether or not it's one that's trustworthy. There's an equivalent for conferences, which we all know that you can get many invitations to conferences. It's not always clear whether these are legitimate or not. And it can also be used if you're thinking about having been invited to be a reviewer or an editor for a journal. It can give you a good framework to think through whether or not you want to engage with this new model. It's a real challenge, I think, to guide people to what a good quality and what a trustworthy publishing outputs at this point. But I think that rather than thinking about straight blacklists or whitelists, having a strategic approach where you can think through the strategy is probably the most useful. Okay, so just some good news really to talk about. And again, this is, I'm expecting that you will be having to speak to academics perhaps about what the benefits are for open scholarship. And what I think it's quite useful to reinforce is that there is now good research out there that demonstrates the systematic value of open research across the publishing life cycle. So first off is that open access content is highly visible. A very recent study actually showed that Google Scholar is an extremely good place to find open research. And we know actually there's fairly good evidence that open articles versus subscription articles actually preferentially appear on Google searches. If you're searching for open content yourself, Unpaywall is a very useful place to go, and there's actually a plugin that you can have onto your browser to direct you to open versions of research articles. On the bottom right, Open Access button also has some really good resources for finding open content. So these are really good places to direct people to. With regard to the downloads and citations, we know that these are both increased for open content. So on the left is a slide of an actual natural experiment within one publisher that showed the top line, which has open access articles versus the bottom of subscription articles, the increased downloads for the open content that increases over time. And on the right hand side, you see an increase for citations. That is particularly the case for open access articles that are deposited in repositories. It's very interesting to see that, and this finding is absolutely consistent across a number of studies nowadays. So again, just reinforces the value of repositories, particularly those associated with universities, as very good places to make research available. For books and book chapters, this may well be very relevant to you, but we know that it's absolutely the case that books get more citations, more downloads, and more online mentions than non-open access books. And the numbers can be quite striking, 50% more citations for open access books. Same is true for coverage in the media. Why I think this is really important is because we know that we want to see good quality media coverage of research. And actually not having good quality coverage of research is actually associated with journalists not being able to get access to papers. And journalists, we know, love open content. And increasingly we're seeing that they are even providing links to open content of research. One area just to touch on is Wikipedia. I'm very fond of Wikipedia as a source. I know that it has... in the past, people have had concerns about the quality of the research or of the work that's in Wikipedia or the content that's in there. This slide really just makes the point about the enormous readership of Wikipedia compared with theses, journal papers, and indeed the same would be true for books. And for where people, I would say, are concerned about the quality of research or work in Wikipedia, it's worth just considering whether or not you should be editing it. And this is what I absolutely encourage academics to do regularly, is that Wikipedia is an incredibly important source of content for the general public more generally. And we also know that you're more likely for articles that are open to be cited as sources on Wikipedia. Preprints also are associated with increased numbers of citations for the final published article. Preprints are also associated with higher numbers of citations, and we're seeing that is true across all disciplines. Next, the final thing just to note is around data sharing, which again may not be so relevant to your particular area, but I think is worth noting as a trend more generally. So just some points I wanted to note about specific challenges in legal publishing. Now, I want to thank Sandra for having pointed me to some of these, and I'm very happy to follow up with some of them in the discussion at the end. I do think that the issue around the ones that I'm most familiar with, for example, is the last point on this, which is the market dominance of the two very big global publishers. This is something that we've seen across the entirety of the academic publishing landscape. We know that certainly that Elsevier has been a very dominant force within publishing and has led to a sort of skewed way for the academic publishing debate to move. I would say that what we're seeing from my perspective of the global publishing market is that there is a pushback and an understanding of a need to negotiate with these publishers, also to make it very clear that we need to have a good relationship with publishers because they provide a service that is valuable, but at the same time that the service has to be now on the terms for academics and for the users of research and the consumers of content rather than the publishers per se. And I think that all of this has to be considered on a case-by-case basis as we go across each discipline. And so coming to the specific issues around legal publishing, they are very different from many of the ones that are happening in science more generally. But what is most important, I think, at this point is that everybody is actively engaged in these discussions. And so I guess my suggestion to you would be that if you have specific issues that you feel need to be addressed within this area, make sure that they are part of ongoing conversations, particularly if you're sitting within, say, universities who are currently at this point thinking very critically about open scholarship more generally. And I just pulled out these two, which I'm sure two sources for legal information, which I'm sure you're incredibly familiar with. What I was just very struck by when I was looking at them was both of them clearly have both the Australian OSLE and the Case Law Access Project in the US clearly have a massive need and a wish to make research open. I was quite interested by the point from OSLE that they talk about the need for contributors to support it. This is, again, something as I highlighted earlier, infrastructure in open scholarship is not generally tremendously well funded, and I think OSLE is a very nice example of that. And for the Case Law Access Project, I thought it was rather fascinating that they note that although they would like to make the entirety of their work completely open without any need to subscribe or any other restrictions, that currently they're constrained because of their component, their collaboration with a company that is funding them. And I think it'll be very interesting to see whether or not these types of initiatives do get more public funding over the next few years. So I promised I'd talk about equity, and I'm coming to the end of what I want to talk about, but I wanted to just highlight for you the fact that this year's Open Access Week, which is in a couple of weeks' time, has this theme of equity in open access. It's a very complicated issue, and it's causing quite some discussion amongst the open access communities, because we do understand that although we currently have clear inequity of access to knowledge and resources to reading things, it is incredibly important that as we change the ecosystem, we don't then leave people behind and make it, for example, harder for some people to then participate in scholarly communication by publishing. They might be able to read the research, but if they then don't have good venues for publishing in, we've not done ourselves any favour. I don't have any easy answers to this, but I think it's a very interesting concept to consider. And then really just a framework to think about how we might move towards more open scholarship. I'm very struck by this model, which is around the idea of the adoption life cycle. And I was at a talk recently by Brian Nosek, who's a real leader in open scholarship, and he talked about how we might use this to best effect, and rather neatly flipped this whole thing on its side and said, well, if we really want to get most people involved in open scholarship, having a policy is probably not going to be that useful as a single use. We have to do a whole range of things across the entire life cycle to ensure that we have both the tools and we build communities, and we build it, also make it part of the sort of normal part of, for example, academics doing work, and that we reward them for it. So, you know, starting right at the bottom, simply providing tools such as preprint servers is often sufficient to make research open. So I'll just leave you with that as a framework. Okay, we have a number of places that you can get access to any sources of information, and I'll make sure these slides are available, just including a newsletter that we put out very regularly, and there should be one coming out this week, hopefully. And that's the end. So I've covered a huge amount of stuff. I apologise for my computer deciding to cause problems. Very happy to take questions, and we, as I said, we're going to do that through Nerida reading stuff out from the chat room, and then I'll do my best to respond, but also happy to talk offline as well.